In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. But now God knows, anything goes. Good offers too.
Teachers and Writers Collaborative on WNYE-FM presents Everything Goes. I am Ann Whitehouse, and today I am reading from my novel, Fall Love. This is my fifth reading from Fall Love on Everything Goes since 1999, and I am grateful for the opportunity to present my novel in this way. I'd like to add that, as of the autumn of 2001, Fall Love is a published book available in hardcover and paperback at virtual and real bookstores. I also direct listeners who would like to become readers to the website www.xlibris.com/falllove.html. The selection I'm going to read today concerns my character, Bryce Crawford, and his return to his native Mississippi from New York City after a long estrangement from his parents. The reason behind his return is the mortal illness of his favorite relative, his father's brother Bill, and his desire to spend time with Bill while he still can. In this chapter, Bryce savors precious moments with his uncle, and he also explores his feelings about his past. He ponders the boy he was before his differences began to set him apart, including his own illness of multiple sclerosis, and these thoughts lead him to speculations, visions, and realizations. And now I will begin. On September and October Sunday mornings in Mississippi, Bryce heard church bells reverberating with a call to worship, and then the air was given over again to the rustling of leaves and grasses. Thickets of trees invited a man who as a boy had romped among the pines. Bryce sometimes went for a walk in the woods, while the rest of his family spent their Sabbath day sitting in services. For if, as he maintained, devotion was an attitude, then an organ's grandest chords were no more a connection to the sound of prayer inside a person than was a more rustic music. Rippling brooks, or whippoorwills twittering, for example, could be more peaceful presences than the peal of bells or a keyboard's chorus. The youthful Bryce had despised the rural retreats sponsored by his family's church. He couldn't interest himself in a group pursuit that wanted to weave the enclosure of itself around the complex questions. To Bryce, it was too much like netting water with a sieve. Even then, he ambled off by himself. Even then, meaning seemed to come mostly in private to a somewhat troublesome boy who, although he certainly knew how to sulk, at least liked to be active if he didn't enjoy games and was apt to shinny up a tree trunk on a moment's impulse. He had no inkling then of how illness would fell him. And if he had, would anything have really changed? An avowal of agnosticism couldn't keep a stricken adolescent from wondering if his condition was not a judgment. But against what? And why? His universe had never felt firm. Now it crumpled, and he tasted the ash against the slick velvet insides of his mouth. It wasn't often that Bryce wondered what would have become of that solitary but outspoken tree-climbing boy had he stayed healthy. More than old adages reminded him there was little use in conjuring what might have been, but was not. Was he ever a bouncing baby boy? In Meridian, he inspected family documents, letters written in faded inks, and family photographs. in a brown vinyl album titled Keepsakes, and embellished with the picture of a rose, he turned crumbling cream-colored pages mounted with black and white photographs, musing over the images of himself. The dark-eyed child he saw was good-looking enough, though now a stranger. Bryce noticed his deepening curiosity with some surprise. It was natural enough that a trip home should turn a person towards his past, but such backward reflection was not a characteristic he had expected to acquire. Perhaps he was simple after all, and ought not to feel so superior, for it was almost with a greed that he sat on the floor, taking his childhood out of boxes that had stayed up on a closet shelf for so long untouched by anyone else that it seemed as if the things inside had all the while been waiting confidently in their dark for him to return to them. It was hard enough for a man to inspect his early promise if it hadn't been realized, but there were satisfactions to be had in the retrieval of memories Bryce thought he'd irrevocably spent or lost. A faded diagram of a treasure hunt he had once composed seemed more substantial when he held the slip of paper in his hand. He'd done the job so well then that no one found the prize, and in the end he had had to pass on transparent hints to a younger cousin. Had his intrigue been spoiled because no one could follow it, or was it perfect in that it wasn't discovered? Only now did Bryce come to these ponderings, meditating on his intricate, if boyishly ingenious, plan as if it were the project for a philosophy class, or else as if the real clues had been unsuspectedly included by him then, for him now. With old papers and junk spread out on the floor around his cross-legged form, Bryce felt the early entanglements entwining him again. Was his past to trap him after all? Was there no use in having grown older? The ties that bound and confused him in his boyhood had been twisted in a singular direction a few years later, and his subsequent development had been contorted when it should have been shooting straight upward. Gradually he had come to recognize and then to classify the reactions of others to his illness. At times he let these hurt him. Yet, in his deep contemplations of his tragedy, he was freed. When he was suspended as from a knife tip over the abyss in the midst of his nights, he was liberating from resented relationships. It was like a fairy tale that tells how an unworthy wish is ironically granted. Startled out of sleep, in a sudden sweat, he recognized the whole shape of his life beside him. He beheld the dreaded other, that shadow of the self. He saw how he would fall, and constantly fall, and the frigid brilliance of his insight briefly lit up the darkness into which he was plummeting. Then his accelerations dropped him further. Motionless in bed, he experienced vertigo. In free fall, in a vacuum, he touched a being whose substance was not his, and yet his fingertips knew the contours of certain features as if he had laid his hands over his own face. Like a vision glimpsed through water, as close and distant as sleep, his own life turned before him, and the motion was graceful, for he hadn't always been crippled. Tenderly he reached to what lay near him, to what both was and was not himself, while he and it were flung as rapidly and irresistibly as twinned stars through space. However Bryce was persuaded by his nighttime visitations, he kept his conclusions to himself and didn't let them stop him from shrewd daytime appraisals. The healthy boy was now almost mythically beyond him, but the stricken, hopeless adolescent still claimed the mature man. If the adult couldn't redeem his youth, He had learned that, though it was understandable, it was also malicious to wish to antagonize those who meant well when they wanted to sympathize by feeling sorry for him. To make oneself invisible to the world at large, one only needs a place. A middle-class man daydreamed his notions of grandeur. Still, Bryce's modest efforts had yielded most comfortable results, and many an able-bodied person had less vantage on a city than he. He had carved out his niche up where he could see the crowd, but it couldn't crush him. First, he had made a home for himself, and then he'd manned it. Bryce furnished the setting, and Paul the action. Having a dancer underneath the arches might not make them more solid, but it gave them a lift. With Paul around, Bryce encountered space differently, not only his own space or outer space, but a mutual space where two men met, and if unequally, the disparity this time didn't seem to matter. For the lucky part, the true and cherished part, was that there was this thing between them, a real invisible thing that Bryce felt as far as his meridian remove. All his recollections of youthful sentiments and plagues, all his reconnections to his still questioning past, didn't quell it. Now that he was old enough to feel the distance, Bryce had come to greet a hometown that still proffered his childhood in the guise of recent events. He soon fell to puzzling out his reactions in order to see the old, odd context beside the newer, even odder one. Though he was to have more distress than joy this time in Mississippi, his life in Manhattan had made a breach in him, a remove, like the contradictory spaces of glass. It wasn't that Bryce wasn't deeply touched by the reunion with his family. It was that he felt the contacts at once on separate selves, which split the pain that he might bear it better. It was the nature of his illness to reveal itself by an assortment of symptoms that came and went separately. His nerves, as it was explained to Bryce, were laid bare. Confusing apprehensions of reality, as intense as drug-induced psychedelic states, went hand in glove with the body's debility. His clinical presentations, from the prickling of his skin to lapses of vision, conformed to the usual range of symptoms shared by other victims of multiple sclerosis. He also had enjoyed such remissions as to almost lead him to hope he would be well again. Alternating fits of despair and euphoria were the poles of a shameful intimacy that had transformed his life and could end it. Although his doctors tried to make him comfortable, Bryce felt they ignored him in their affair with his disease. They did not trouble themselves too much in wondering to what extent his character claimed and molded the subsequent course of his illness through his body. There were mornings when Bryce awoke with the unreasonable aura of hope that something had happened while he slept and he was cured. But his first conscious movements changed this to depression. And how best to get through the day then? Sometimes he wondered if it would not have been preferable if his symptoms were delusions and he were mad. Yet he had not been feeling particularly bad before he left Manhattan to find, surprisingly, in Meridian, himself standing beside the bed this time. Bryce had seen his shadow, cast by lamplight, fall across his uncle's face at that first meeting. Through the cool sheet, he had lightly touched his uncle's shoulder. In reaction, Bill's eyes had fluttered open, pale and blue, disclosing a crystalline astonishment, like the blankness of a new baby's eyes first beholding the world, a look lasting only a moment before registering recognition of the nephew. Or had Bryce imagined that instant of indifference? So completely has Bill's attention turned it away as it took hold of Bryce. There weren't many words between the men that morning, and sometimes still less in the following days. At other intervals, they talked together quite contentedly, though briefly. For, reunited across the divide of Bill's sickbed, they had instantly found an intimacy. Bryce had known they would. It was why he had flown to Mississippi with an open return, and why he had put the ticket away for the present on his closet shelf. Beyond the lowered blind and the 8 glass panes of the window, a mild wind fluttered in the green light branches of 2 plum trees. The hovering smell of disease had seeped in the walls, but no matter. Bill was alert and willing, at least in August, to enter into a green dream of the past with his nephew. It was a fiercer current than nostalgia that attracted each to the other, for there was an enemy, an evil entity, in the room with him, though neither spoke of it. The days were to pass their light and dark faces and absorb him in Bill. He saw the rest of his family and other people he had lost track of and didn't particularly care to know now, but was polite enough to give the time of day to. And because his reclusive habits were not conducive to company, there were occasions in September and October when he just went off by himself. He made himself agreeable to errands. He let down his guard and told himself it was character improvement. In the important ways, he protected his privacy. There were 2 sides to his daily trips to Bill's house. It was precisely when he wasn't next to Bill that he mentally conjured what the man had once been, at least for him. Like a ritual act, this gave him courage. These recollections were vividly engendered, a lining of light behind a dark cloud. Bryce remembered a man with a boy behind him on horseback, ambling among nodding grasses and waving leaves, the spring air fresh enough for only a flannel shirt. He vowed that these moments in the past would remain fixed permanently in the inner eye, unharmed by what had already damaged so much. Access to the sick room, as Bill's condition worsened, was gradually limited, yet Bryce was always let inside. Given the timetable that was to assert itself as the leaves changed their color and furled, Bryce had come soon enough for a long-held love to reaffirm itself. This was a fact of greater fervor in the shortening days, in those hours when Bill scarcely seemed to notice anyone, in the entire week when he left the blind drawn all day and didn't want to look out any more on the lawn and the sky and the trees hung with their last fruit, already pitted and spoiled by marauding birds. After a while, Bill's doctor withdrew the injections of poisonous chemicals. He gave pills for pain and little else. The protracted death prolonged Bryce's visit to Mississippi, a tame death in the old style that would happen at home. But in the meantime, in the still summertime September, when the frosts seem as far off as stars, there was an afternoon when Bill felt well enough to sit on the porch with a blanket over his knees and Bryce beside him, when he asked for a chunk of wood from the pile in the shed, even requested white pine. "Got your knife on you, boy?" Bill asked Bryce after he had come back with a handsome piece, but the boy couldn't even find a penknife on his person. The blade that Bill brought out from his bathrobe pocket was dangerously sharp, set in a handle of inlaid bone, and so it was that Bill took to whittling all by himself, his empty-handed nephew looking on. Bryce found this sight of his uncle in quiet absorption soothing as he watched the thin shavings curl and pile at his uncle's feet, blonder than straw. There was a patience in the sick man's hands, even if they shook just perceptibly where they had been steady, slipped once, and took off a good-sized chip, pointed jaggedly at one end and rounded at the other, which Bryce picked up and held in his palm. Though he sat a yard away, Bryce didn't pull his chair any closer, nor did he break the silence to ask his uncle what he was making. Bill was to abandon the whittling whimsically begun this autumn afternoon, leaving unfinished a disc in the shape of an oyster shell. With the first strokes of his knife that day, he might have been sculpting the wood into any number of things. Between the shadows cast by the porch's columns, elongated stripes of sunlight were a cautionary clock. "Tell me when you're tired, Uncle Bill," Bryce had planned to say, but didn't. Too moved to speak by the beauty of the delicate, exposed face down-slanting away from him, intent on the task, despite a throbbing pulse at the base of the left eye. Like the involuntary tremor of the hand, it was a motion Bill hadn't willed and couldn't control. Each day spent with Bill has turned out to be different from what preceded or is bound to follow, mused Bryce. As he watched his uncle's hand still confidently wield the knife, he slipped the wood chip he had salvaged into his pocket, feeling, despite their desultory conversation, the rareness of the moment. When his fingers trembled, Bill halted until the shaking passed, and when he had had enough, he closed the knife blade and stood up by himself while Bryce held open the back door. Bryce kept the chip of wood. He liked to lay it in his palm and turn it over, press the tip into his forefinger, run his thumb with the smoothness of the grain along the sides. On a cloudy Sunday morning in mid-October, Bryce drove to a state forest in the adjoining county and selected a trail which he had hiked in his boyhood and which wasn't too steep. He parked his parents' second car and locked it, put on a parka, and, wielding a stick, entered the woods where the heads of the trails converged. They fanned out at the onset and then continued in parallel tracks down and along valleys and ridges before meeting again at a waterfall. Bryce wouldn't tackle that trip today, but would instead take a shortcut that crossed to the valley trail from the one on the ridge. So, he'd have to climb first and get it over with. He stumbled on a tree root, but caught himself with the stick and made the climb rather easily, breathing lightly. Not until he reached the top did he realize that a soft mist of rain clung to the pine needles and the changing leaves. The ground was damp, but not wet. By a trick of the light, the woods appeared to recede before Bryce just as he approached them, upright and evergreen, with patches of hardwood, darkening hickory, and bare rocks as lookout points, and open weedy places where the day looked in, as dim as a summer twilight, though it was close to noon. Stretched in a single plain across the trail where Bryce was to pass was an immense cobweb as tall as a man. Its numerous long guy lines were anchored in three dimensions, attached to nodding reeds and small leafed bushes, to the coarse white edges of grass blades, to snags in the peeling bark of a pine tree, and to dead twigs on living trees and fallen logs. He didn't spot the web until almost upon it, and only then because its threads were fretted with moisture. At once he started back. He saw the spider, large and spotted, and the several trapped and tied insects whose death had preserved their delicate structures. He wouldn't have wanted to tangle with those sticky threads himself. But before he made a detour, he inspected the web more closely. Hanging liquid from the lines, rain droplets expanded to translucent globes that distorted what they reflected. Standing thus in sight of the web's static symmetry, Bryce experienced the curious disorientation that either it was revolving or he was. It chilled him. Seeing a web like that, strung across the trail as if it were meant for a person. He had almost been snared, but now he looked at the loveliness, the long looping lines, and the radii that extended their design. That was what he recognized first, the pattern, and then the empty spaces it spanned, a stretched framework that suggested by obverse, the absence it bridged in that its lines met around holes. Thus, a void opened for Bryce in the taut, breathing mesh his life made with the mortal world. He felt himself in a dream landscape, green, moist, and muted, with something nightmarish in the way that the light was muffled. Besides the threat to himself, he sensed a space, an absence like a sudden chilly breath of air that settled from the open sky on his bare head. The web was something he'd seen through, but hadn't penetrated. He bypassed it and the other smaller webs he came across later by leaving the path and walking around them. Just as he left the woods, he caught himself listening for the slip of his step on fallen pine needles. It was the slightness of that sound that accentuated the stillness he had found himself traveling past. The rain never fell in full force that day, and, driving back to his parents' house, Bryce kept flicking on and off the windshield wipers. Though the day was still gloomy, he felt gladder after his walk, and the glow stayed with him, calm and cool in the pit of his being, like phosphorescent gleams in water. For Teachers and Writers Collaborative, I'm Ann Whitehouse. Everything Goes is recorded by Tom Ronan and produced by Erwin Gonshack in the studios of WNYE-FM, New York.
Good authors, too, who once knew better words, now only use four-letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old kids